And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
You can judge a man by how he treats the least among us. Well, the same applies to judging women, and Sarah Palin demands that we apply the same standard to her and her candidacy. In Alaska, Governor Palin has much impact on the lives of some of our nation's most unique Native peoples. So how does she treat those who ask simply to maintain their subsistence lives? You'll find out when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Perhaps you've heard about the DVD that is being distributed through newspapers to over 28 million people. It's a full-length documentary on the threats to America from Islamic terrorists. It's called Obsession. There are many potential threats to our way of life, and today I continue my obsession with one that I find literally in our front yard, namely, the possibility that Sarah Palin could become president of the United States. To me, this is a far more present danger to the lives of all Americans, and one that we have to take very seriously. According to authoritative actuarial tables, there is a 1-in-3 chance that Sarah Palin would become the next president if she and McCain were elected. America has always been, for me, more than just a collection of people within the boundaries of our 50 states. It is, in fact, a legacy of a march towards an option for people to decide their own destiny, based on the collective will expressed through the democratic process. And what has distinguished the American ethos is a respect for those with whom any one of us, and most importantly, the majority, may disagree. This built-in spirit of tolerance, respect, and kindness is perhaps the true expression of one nation under God that I can summon. But I am compelled to state clearly that a form of brutishness, intolerance, and arrogance has taken over our nation ever since the Bush administration took power. We have witnessed some of the most divisive and elitist rhetoric coming from the decider and the army of attack dogs that comprise and promote the Bush doctrine. This is a radical change in the character of American politics in the modern age. It is not politics as usual. Certainly politics have been ugly, mean-spirited, and often crass in the past. But now with the capability of pounding fear, contempt, and smears endlessly through highly coordinated messaging from talking heads on TV, ranting righties on radio, and blustering buffooniacs on right-wing blogs, the accumulating depth of crap is impeding the goodwill of those who live good lives as liberals or students, families, small businesses, folks, and common riffraff amongst us, who live each day with a true American moral compass that steers us towards tolerance and common decency in our dialogue. But with this election, we are now confronted with Sarah Palin, who has some agenda, although I can't think of anyone who can define it, because she blunders each time she tries to articulate it effectively herself. And with her lack of a refined sense of who Americans are, perhaps from her hanging out far too long with far too many Joe Sixpacks, God love 'em, who salute the flag with one hand while the other hand throws another empty beer can on the carpet, she blindly tosses out implications that we need to be really careful with a guy like Barack Hussein Obama, because he hangs out with terrorists. Her witless sense of judgment that would tell almost any rational American that such pitiful attempts at character assassination tend to inspire some drunken Joe Sixpack to get it over with and shoot that dirty bastard traitor. It exhibits a reckless style unbefitting anyone who even pretends to claim the right to lead this nation. Character assassination inspires assassination. Does she even lack the most elemental common sense to refrain from the mindless appellation of the subliminally seditious slander? And that is why today I continue to reveal the real Sarah Palin, focusing on her legacy towards the native peoples of her native state. As you will hear, these people whose literal survival depends on the recent judgment of any governor of Alaska find Sarah Palin's worldview blind to the subtleties of balance between people and their environment as they ask for their right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So now, and continuing in segment two of today's show, we talk with attorney Lloyd Miller, who is a native rights attorney and partner in the Alaska law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Sashi, Anderson, and Perry.
Much of my work has involved litigating matters between tribes in Alaska, outside Alaska, and the United States government. And to some extent, the litigation has also involved tribes resolving disputes with state governments. I've had cases that unfortunately have to go all the way to the Supreme Court, but fortunately we've prevailed, and the cases in many of the courts of appeals around the country.
And how long have you been focused in this particular area yourself?
My entire career, since I left law school and finished a clerkship in 1979.
I guess what I'd like to investigate first of all, how her governorship and potential presidency ultimately, since you've been involved in Native issues for a long time, I'd like to discuss the issues and the trends and how they've developed over that time. Are they getting better? Are they getting worse? What are the major issues?
American Indian policy really has vacillated over the last century and a half. It has gone from a tradition of seeking to assimilate, if not eliminate, Native American people from the national scene to policies of separation and reservation life, to an era that really began in the early 1970s, in which we still find ourselves, and that's the tribal self-determination era, or the Indian self-determination era. This has been really an enlightened policy that was brought about by tremendous tribal advocacy during the civil rights years of the 1960s. Congress responded with the Indian Self-Determination Act and with the Indian Civil Rights Act and a number of other statutes designed to strengthen tribal governments, to get tribal governments out from under the yoke of federal oppression, to get tribes out from under the thumb of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which is an agency within the U.S. Department of the Interior, and to permit the tribes to reclaim their original sovereignty and to strengthen it. Now, over this long arc of time, these last 30 years, Congress has adhered pretty closely to that tradition and has acted in the areas of law enforcement, tribal courts, infrastructure, and other areas to do what it can to remove the obstacles that stand in the way of tribes being able to take over greater control over their own communities and their own futures. Sometimes this movement has been rapid, and sometimes it hasn't been, but I would say that it hasn't changed course. In the last 8 years, there's been very little movement forward in terms of tribal self-determination policy from the federal government. The president has certainly shown no interest, much less leadership, in this area. And Congress, as a result, and of course as a result of the distraction of other national and international matters, has likewise not devoted substantial energy in this area. And I think many of us who work with Indian tribes, who advocate for tribes, wonder whether the next administration will signal a new beginning, more of the same, or backtracking. Of course, we won't know till the election is over, but it becomes a very important election for Native American people as they look for some change from the policies that have prevailed over the last 8 years.
Historically, the issue about Native American sovereignty and identity and dignity and self-determination is very complex, but there must be some major themes that run throughout that probably are the areas of struggle and where you're finding the most need to focus. Historically, leading up to this last 8 years, what may some of those main themes have been?
Well, I think one of the greatest difficulties has been in law enforcement and related issues of jurisdiction in Indian communities. Much of the problem in this area has been born of Supreme Court decisions. The United States Supreme Court has issued rulings in various cases that have had the effect of dismantling the ability of tribes to coherently govern their own communities by instead requiring that tribes behave differently depending on the race or membership of individuals they encounter as potential criminal defendants, by requiring that tribes behave differently depending on land ownership within their communities, really fractionating tribal sovereignty in a way that is completely incoherent, makes no sense, is something that would never be visited upon a local city government or state government, but is something that the Supreme Court has saddled tribes with and has produced a tremendous loss of control locally. Now, Congress could, by my measure, Congress should respond to these decisions by enacting legislation that in this area overturns those Supreme Court decisions and rights the ship. Congress has the authority to do that under the Constitution in this area, and in fact it has exercised that power in the past, but not over the last 8 years. And nobody for a moment thinks that any corrective legislation would be able to pass without a very supportive president and a supportive Congress.
And I always hesitate to talk on behalf of Native Americans because, first of all, it's an extremely diverse group of people stretching throughout all of the Americas. So that being said, I will generalize and say this. From my perspective, there does seem to be a very unique relationship, very profound relationship, generally speaking, between people and their land. It's the grounding of who they are. And again, I'm generalizing because in some cases that's not so much the case. But I think traditionally that has been where some of the rubber meets the road in terms of these definitions and the trends. And that to me is an extremely important aspect as it relates to Native Americans, Native people, and indigenous people in Alaska, specifically where some of these villages and towns and peoples go back thousands of years and are struggling now to maintain their way or to identify their way or restore their way as it relates to their land. But now you have the added influence of encroachment and policies that begin to dramatically impact that way of life. Can you give us a sense of how that's playing out in Alaska?
I can. I think your remarks are very profound and insightful. Someone who comes to Village Alaska for the first time, who is familiar with Native American communities outside Alaska, would find something striking, and that is that the Native people on the coast of Alaska and along the villages, by and large, still speak their own language, to varying extents, still live a way of life that's based on the seasons, a subsistence way of life, we call it, based on hunting and fishing, gathering, and teaching generations through those activities, teaching values through those activities. They are communities that are as indigenous and aboriginal as one could imagine within the United States. And yet, the irony of it is that although in many places, in most places in Alaska, this is the case, the village tribes in Alaska lack the recognized authority over their lands that the Sioux tribes have, that the Navajo Nation has, that tribes elsewhere in the United States have. And it is because the United States Congress took a different approach to Alaska Native affairs than it took vis-a-vis other Native American peoples. The approach the Congress took, which was embedded in the statute adopted in 1971, reflected a unique combination of pressures between the state of Alaska, the oil companies, the United States, and the Alaska Native tribes that had laid claim at that time to most of the state and whose claims were barring the development of the oil fields on the North Slope. The unique settlement that Congress achieved at that time, called a settlement but imposed upon the tribes, dispossessed the land from the people and put the land instead into Alaska Native corporations. The corporations were to have members who were Alaska Native people, so each tribe's members would become shareholders of a corporation, and the corporation would then be free to develop the lands under various provisions of state and special corporate law. But the people who lived in the communities no longer had a right to walk on their own lands as tribal land. Instead, these lands now belonged to a corporation. Worse than that, Congress terminated and extinguished all native hunting and fishing rights. And in doing this, Congress said that it expected that the state of Alaska and the Secretary of the Interior would take cooperative action to put into place measures that would assure that Native people would continue being able to hunt and fish as they had for generations, for millennia. Turned out that did not happen. And not surprising, I think, if one looks at the experience in any other place in America. State governments are generally not friendly to Native American hunting and fishing rights, and much more often than not combat those rights, seek to extract as much of those resources for the benefit of the non-Native population. And Alaska proved to be no different. After a few years of a failed effort to secure hunting and fishing rights for Native people, Congress actually had to come back in and rescue the situation and enact a new statute that recreated, if you will, hunting and fishing rights in rural Alaska. But it's been a real struggle, and it is for this reason. These combined forces, the tremendous tie that Native people in Alaska in particular have to the land, because the land sustains them, literally sustains them, that hunting and fishing rights in Alaska are so vitally important.
That adds an extraordinary dimension that I was completely unaware of. I did not know that, in essence, the rights to the land had been stripped from the original owners. That really complicates the matter. I can't even imagine how you work your way through that legally. But that has direct implications in terms of the, we'll kind of bring this into the Palin governorship, because that has been a huge part of her legacy as governor, impacting virtually almost every aspect of life in Alaska. Can you give us a sense of who she is and how she kind of sees the world is affecting Native Americans in these issues?
Like the story about the blind people who are touching the elephant trying to figure out what it is, I only see Governor Palin through this narrow lens of Native American issues. I can't really give you a sense of the whole person. I wouldn't try to. But any governor in Alaska will have tremendous responsibility in areas of hunting and fishing rights. And the reason for this takes a little bit of explaining, but then you'll see what I mean. When Congress passed this legislation that restored hunting and fishing rights, it restored them under a very unique regime. And it requires remembering what our Constitution says Congress can and cannot do to understand. Congress regulates activities on federal lands. Congress does not regulate activities on state land, but fish and game don't know boundaries. So fish go up rivers through state and federal lands, and caribou herds migrate across state and federal lands, and for that matter, Native corporate lands also. How do you get a single regime in place that covers Native rights to hunt and fish on all lands, because they live in a patchwork area of state, federal, and Native corporate lands? Congress passed a piece of legislation that established a priority for subsistence hunting and fishing activities in all federal waters and federal lands. And then it told the state, if you will adopt an identical program for your state lands, we will turn over management of the federal lands to you, the state. And the state, in fact, accepted that offer and carried out a program, albeit one that was frequently challenged as being far too weak, for a few years. And then in the early 1990s, the state Supreme Court ruled that the state's action under this federal legislation actually violated the state constitution. As a result of that, the federal government came in and started managing subsistence hunting and fishing rights on federal lands and waters. Today, we now have a dual system where the state of Alaska regulates hunting and fishing on state lands, including Native corporate lands, which is a bit ironic since it's somewhat hostile to Native rights and yet is regulating hunting and fishing on Native lands.
They regulate and manage those rights.
But since the Alaska Native villagers engage in much hunting and fishing on federal lands and in federal waters, the federal government protects hunting and fishing there. So you have a dual system. In that setting, the governor for the state of Alaska has the ability to do two things, to react to the federal regime and to control the state regime. When it comes to the federal regime, the administration under Governor Palin carrying over from positions taken by her prior administration, the Murkowski administration, has leveled a broadside attack on the entire federal regime and sought to dismantle it. That is a direct attack on native hunting and fishing rights, primarily fishing rights, on federal waters and federal lands. On the state side, she has tolerated people on the state board that are openly racist, including one individual who chaired the board who accused people who were coming to testify at hearings as being more interested in buying beer than testifying. I mean, really outrageous, openly racist remarks. So in my experience, which is just a narrow slice, I find that the Palin administration has been, in the area of hunting and fishing rights, particularly hostile to Native interests. Now, having said that, I don't think it's motivated out of animus to Native people. Well, I am in no position to say. I think what it's motivated by is a desire to maximize the amount of fish and game available for sport hunters and sport fishers, and as well as a commercial fishery. Here the issue is not so much whether more fishing or less fishing should occur overall, whether more hunting or less hunting should occur overall vis-a-vis particular herds of particular stocks. Mm-hmm. It's who should take the numbers that have been designated by the biologists as appropriate to take without damaging the herd.
I appreciate that perspective.
And the economic interests in the state of Alaska are the economic interests behind the sport hunters and the commercial fishermen and sport fishermen. It is not the native people on the ground. Well, I think it's the economic powers that dictate what happens to fish and game in our state. And the native people come last. The native people who live in the villages, who depend upon fish and game, only prevail to the extent they do because they have federal regime in place for federal lands and waters, and because there still are some state laws in place that give at least some preference for native rural subsistence users. But it has become so diluted compared to the federal regime that it really has little resemblance to it. Again, the reason is very clear. There aren't enough fish and game to satisfy all needs. And the state has chosen, in various means, both by attacking the federal system and by altering its own system, to maximize the amount that's allocated to the sport and commercial sectors, even if that comes at the price of the native and rural subsistence users. And that's plain as day.
And then, of course, we have Sarah Palin's lofty thoughts on aerial hunting of wolves and bear. We focus our sights on this and more when your voice of the earth returns, here on the Wild Side News.
Way up north,
up to Alaska.
Way up north,
up to Alaska.
North to Alaska, go north for Russia's own.
North
to Alaska, go north for Russia's own. Big Sam left Seattle in the year of 92
with George Pratt, his partner, and brother Billy, too. They crossed the Yukon River and found the Bonanza Gold
below that old white mountain just a little southeast of Nome. Sam crossed the majestic mountains to the valleys far below.
He talked to his team of Huskies as he mushed on through the snow, with the northern lights a-running wild in the land of the midnight sun.
Yes, Sam McCord was a mighty man in the year of 1901. Where the river is winding, big nuggets they're finding.
North
to Alaska, we're going north, the rush is on.
Away up north.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
A Palin vice presidency would provide her with a platform to carry out her mission, which to many appears to be to maximize the taking of resources of all kinds on her new domain, America's public lands and its seashores. And, well, where does her vision end? Life is rugged in Alaska, that's a fact. But has it calloused her soul to the great and lofty wonders that enrich and inspire the lives and spirit of America? We find out when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Our conversation with Lloyd Miller continues. You know, the story that we kind of talk about here have to do with aerial hunting, otherwise it's known as predator control, using airplanes to impact wolves and bear. What are your thoughts about the balance there in terms of what's trying to be accomplished or who is being served by that particular action, which a lot of people are opposed to?
Well, it's a controversial issue, one that by all accounts is based more on politics than it is on science. I don't think there is any sound science that supports the program the state has underway to try to control predators through aerial hunting. But to me, the real way in which we discern whether or not a Palin presidency would be friendly to native hunting and fishing rights is to see what she's done, not in terms of enhancing particular stocks of game, but what she's done in allocating the stocks that exist. And there, I think, this administration has been woefully deficient. I mean, I have to add that what makes, I think, this particularly offensive to many people in the villages, but as you said for yourself, I'm not going to speak for them, they'll speak for themselves, is that by mentioning, not infrequently, that her husband has some native heritage, the governor is trying to suggest to the American public that that means she has a particular sensitivity in her heart for issues of importance to Native people. The problem is that her actions have never reflected that sensitivity. She comes from a region of the state, Wasilla, which is about as right-wing as they come and unsympathetic to Native issues as anywhere in the state of Alaska. And again, her conduct, not just in hunting and fishing issues, but we may talk about it in the area of tribal self-governance, show a hostility to Native interests.
I know, for example, Wasilla is at the end of Knik Arm Inlet, the other bridge to nowhere that is being proposed, and that apparently she's somewhat in favor. But there is the beluga whale that exists in that area, which has been a mainstay of some tribes historically. Those populations began to diminish, and this became, I'm not intimately familiar with this history, but the fact that the populations were diminishing were brought up to the native peoples, and there's apparently was a compromise reached around the hunting and taking of those whales. However, since that time, the whale populations have diminished, but there is at this point no willingness on her part to take action, to use science, to institute regulations to protect those whales, and there's many impacts that are affecting the whale. It's this type of management and approach that indicates to me that there is an incredible insensitivity to these broad issues.
When we talk about the second bridge to nowhere, which would cross the Knik Arm and land in a location that has no population, we are talking about a project that would cost hundreds of millions of dollars and destroy the habitat of the declining beluga whale. Beluga whales as a species, other than environmentalists, which shouldn't be discounted, is only important to one people, and that's the Native people. And you weigh that in the Palin administration against the desire to see a several hundred million dollar project go forward and bring the associated economic benefits to the state, and the answer is clear. The state is going to oppose anything that would prioritize the survival of the beluga whale in Cook Inlet.
That is one of many, many indicators. And let's talk a little bit about, for example, some of the mining issues and the pollution of salmon rivers and others. Give us some examples of where this pattern shows itself. Because from my perspective, that there's a pattern here, and that pattern isn't going to change, I don't believe, if Sarah Palin were to become the active vice president and ultimately the president.
There are many issues in the state where state's interest in development come up against the interest in preservation of resources for subsistence. But indeed, they come up in terms of preservation of resources for commercial and sport activities as well. And I think the most notable one that's gotten the most press, certainly, is the Pebble Mine development. And the Pebble Mine development will be, if it occurs, the second largest open pit development in the world, in the area, the headwaters of the largest wild fishery in the world. There's been a tremendous amount of concern over the possible development of this mine in the state. There was recently an initiative, which was a fairly complex effort to amend state law. Quite a lot of misunderstanding about it, but there's no mistaking that over 80% of the people who live in the affected areas, called Southwest Alaska, the Bristol Bay drainage, voted against the development of Pebble Mine. The governor has indicated sympathy for the Pebble Mine development. And it's interesting because of all people, Senator Stevens opposed the Pebble Mine development. Many people have various opinions of Senator Stevens, our senior senator from Alaska. But on this issue, he's been clear, and he's generally been a strong advocate of native interests in certain domains.
Is this a classic cyanide leach field mine?
I'm not a scientist.
Okay, that sometimes becomes the issue, and that's that in order to draw the gold from the ore, massive cyanide lakes are created. And I don't know myself, but if that were the case, and the cyanide lakes that they use to process and draw the gold out of, that be, think about that at the headwater of one of the world's largest stocks of fish.
In fact, they will have to build a dam that's larger than any dam ever been built.
For the purpose of?
Holding back the water.
Holding back the water.
That will be used in this mining operation.
Yes. Trending again. This is a framing that I keep on talking about. As we look into the development of oil and energy and natural gas, and Alaska is going to be facing this challenge for long into the future here. And I don't know if there's going to be any way to stop that or even really slow it down. So the question becomes one of oversight and leadership in terms of applying real science, whether, and I mean technologies, that are the best technologies or even advancing better technologies, such that if that's going to happen, the trend will be that as it increases, the chances of there being serious impacts will be lessened. I don't know that based on what I see that that's going to be her mission.
No, I don't either. I think her mission will be to develop as much of our country's federal estate as possible if she is the president, and going at least as far as, presumably further than President Bush went in mandating that federal lands be drilled, mined, and otherwise maximized for economic profit, I mean traditional economic profit, rather than other values associated with those lands, indeed hunting, fishing, protection for native resources, protection for the biodiversity that we need to sustain ourselves.
And even from my perspective, the American way of life, and meaning literally Native American, and as well traditional small-town Americans, people who make up the bulk of the vast landscape in America, who share many of the same concerns and issues about maintaining their environment, that we do have an appreciation and even almost a sense of sacredness of our land. Many of us do. Many of us do. Even in our national anthems, we sing about such things. And unfortunately, it seems as if all of those values that, to me, define a unique character of America are being washed away and just abandoned and turned on their head. You're certainly witnessing that in your realms.
Another area where we have seen what a Palin presidency might look like is when the state has confronted issues of tribal self-government, tribal sovereignty, tribal self-determination. The governor is foursquare opposed to the assertion of tribal sovereignty by Alaska Native villages. Now, by way of background, we have over 200 federally recognized tribes in Alaska. As I mentioned earlier, the lands have been severed and put into the hands of a different entity called a corporation. But that said, the tribes are still there, and the tribes are there, and the villages are doing the best they can in providing law and order, taking care of families, building roads and bridges, doing the business of government, which is more tedious than exciting most of the time. That's what they do. But Governor Palin has reaffirmed an edict issued by the predecessor governor, his attorney general, which said that Alaska villages had no authority, the tribes in Alaska have no authority to do anything whatsoever of a governmental nature, not even to take care of children who are in need of foster care placement, who are suffering abuse or neglect, not even to do that, unless the state is asked and grants permission in a lawsuit in a state court. Now, we have a vast state. We have a state that's 375 million acres. The great arm of the state, fortunately, doesn't reach many communities. Majority of the communities don't even have what's called a village public safety officer. So the only law enforcement mechanism is a tribal law enforcement mechanism, and the only government is a tribal council in many villages. And there'll be a tribal court or a council of elders. Different villages run their affairs in different ways. But the one thing that is critically important is that they have absolute control over the care of their children.
Yes.
The state of Alaska has opposed that. Governor Palin has opposed. She has opposed it in state court. She has opposed it in federal court. the odd thing about it, or the shocking thing, I should say, about it, is that she's lost in her own state courthouse. The judges have ruled that the state is wrong to try to deny the authority of tribes to take care of their own children. So is the federal court. But the Palin administration has vowed to take appeals and is taking appeals in both of those cases.
That's radical.
Now, it is an insensitivity that goes beyond comprehension, because in the name of some esoteric concern about states' rights, children hang in the balance, and children are being hurt. The state has no ability, has no mechanism to reach out and take care of these children. Never mind that the experience we've had in Alaska with the state doing so has been terrible. It's been an abject failure. That's another story. So these children have no protection if the tribe is denied the ability to protect them. Now, fortunately, the tribes do. They're not going to stop. And fortunately, the courts are with the tribes. And the courts will defend, so far, the right of the tribe to take care of their own children, to place a child in a safe environment, to make sure the child is cared for, and to do all the things necessary to maintain the integrity of a family. And if necessary, to take a child out of a family and move it in put that child in a better place. But the state, notwithstanding they've lost this issue, persist in denying the power of tribes to do this. It borders on the criminal.
Well, it's really odd about you, having lived in New Mexico, where you talk about nations, the Navajo Nation or the Apache Nation, and they have literal national status and rights of self-determination to a very large degree. And therefore, you sort of have this tribal nation that lives within states' rights and federal rights. And this issue, which is typically a conservative issue of states' rights, one would think, if one applied relative logic and a sense of fairness and judgment, should extend naturally to honor the rights of tribal peoples as well, to have that sense of self-determination and rights.
Well, absolutely. This litigation has played out in the past in Alaska. There have been two governors, Governor Murkowski, Governor Palin's predecessor, and Governor Palin, who've taken this very hard position. In the litigation, the United States Department of Justice has appeared in some of these cases and taken the position of the tribes, which has been very important and much appreciated by the tribal community. But now you have to wonder, if the president changes, if the president becomes President Palin one day, is the Justice Department going to be instructed to take a different position and to support a states' rights approach on Native issues? And if on Native issues, how about African-American issues? I mean, are we going to see a wholesale shift again in the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, as we did early on in the Bush years?
I'm just curious, what do you think drives this?
You know, motives are less important to me than actions.
Yes.
And
yes,
the actions here have been very destabilizing for regime of tribal self-determination. Mm-hmm. And whoever people vote for, they need to know this is out there. Mm-hmm. And especially Native American communities need to know what the score is. It's complicated. It's going to be a complicated election. Senator McCain has a long and distinguished record of advocacy for Native American interests. He was the chairman of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee and shepherded through important legislation, and I pay tribute to that. I worked with him and his staff and accomplished great things, I think, in the 1980s, particularly when he was chair in the 80s and early 90s, I should say. But on a McCain-Palin ticket, Senator McCain, at his age, if he becomes president, raises the very real specter that he may have to leave the presidency, he may become disabled, diminished in such a way that the vice president becomes president. And Senator Palin is diametrically opposed to the views of Senator McCain when it comes to Native American issues.
To a large degree, many people in the United States have felt that things are kind of out of control, that decisions are being made by deciders as opposed to following democratic precedent and the rights of people to decide, and that decisions are made arbitrarily by those who sense that they have the whatever is the divine right of kings or whatever it may be to make decisions. And I can sense, I'm just sensing now, that when it filters out into Alaska and to small villages and peoples, that they would have a sense of helplessness, that they are set adrift. Who do you turn to at that point? I would hate to be in that position. I personally would be angry about that. I would feel very unsettled in my soul.
Well, I think that's why this is such a watershed election. And it turns out, across the many battleground states, which used to include Alaska, There used to be four, now three of the battleground states are states with large Native American populations. And I think the Native American community feels very empowered in those states. I mean, just take Montana, for example, where the Native American vote secured the seat for Senator Tester. A very recent example of the power of the vote. People get registered and people get out. I think we're going to see a continuation of this powerful get-out-the-vote movement in Montana and New Mexico and South Dakota and in Alaska. Maybe Alaska will surprise us. I think a majority of Alaskans will vote for their favorite daughter, if you will, notwithstanding perhaps some of the unease over other issues.
You've added many dimensions to the story of Sarah Palin. How might people learn more about this? What would you recommend that they do?
I would encourage people to write letters to the editor or do the, I'm an old-fashioned guy, but do the comparable approach on the Internet. I guess that's in the blogosphere. Voices need to be heard, and it's surprising to me. I recently wrote a piece with my wife that just tried to get some facts out. Here are cases that involve the governor. Here's what the governor's trying to do in this particular case and tells you how to find that case. And it was stunning to me, not just how fast it went around the country, but how it kept going around and is still going around. It's only 10 days old, showing up all sorts of places. I'm naive on the use of the Internet. You are not. But I think if your listeners are connecting to you, that means they are much more sophisticated than I. And I encourage them to have this kind of dialogue on the Internet so that voters are educated to what's at stake in this country.
Sarah Palin is going to have to actually answer questions, at least I hope at some point people will be able to put real questions to her, although perhaps not. Things may be so regulated that that may not happen. And that is the antithesis of what democracy is about. But if anyone should have the chance to actually ask Sarah Palin a question, these kinds of issues, she needs to address these issues. So I encourage them, just speak up, be respectful, but bring these things forward, because the press is actually, I'm finding that the press is willing to take a little deeper look, and thank God for that.
People have to make sure those questions get asked, listen to the answer, and fact-check it. Fact-check me, fact-check you, and fact-check Palin.
Yes.
Because I tell you, when I hear Sarah Palin tell a national audience at the Republican convention that she said no thanks to the Ketchikan Bridge to Nowhere, it's absolutely untrue. Absolutely untrue. She actually took the money that was designated for that bridge and kept it. She didn't say no thanks to anything, and in fact championed the bridge when she was running for governor. So, you know, listen, have those questions asked, listen to the answers, then fact check them, and then get the word out on what the truth is.
From my perspective, this is my editorial opinion, there is a disingenuousness that permeates Sarah Palin, where some connection with the truth and her capacity to tell the truth straight out, she seems to be in conflict with that far too often. We need straight answers. We need real intelligence and wisdom right now. And I'm sorry, but I just really am concerned about her approach to her power. We're talking with Lloyd Miller, who's an attorney in Anchorage, but as well Washington, D.C. Lloyd, why don't you give the name of your law firm again, and perhaps before this is over, we'll talk again.
Yes, my law firm is Sanofsky Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, and it's been a pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you so much, Mr. Miller.
Where the river is winding, big nuggets they're finding.
In a strange twist of history, we perhaps are entering a phase when politics as usual, in which candidates at least want to appear to be intelligent, returns. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Tuesday, or any time in the archives, and next week with a grand unveiling of a brand new Wildside News, when your voice of the earth rings out around the world, here on the Wildside News.